it's time for Sports Lit 101. Looking forward to talking with the author of a book that we've chatted about a couple of times, Bruce. What a wonderful read this was from author Patrick Mosier.
It was a wonderful read, Surf and Rescue, George Freeth and the Birth of California Beach Culture. What was really great about it was it became the prequel to something we had been fascinated by before in another book. And it really, our goal always in this segment is to learn something. We always want to learn something from books and feel like we not only enjoyed what we read, but we got something out of it. And that was certainly the case. So, Patrick, welcome to Downtown.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate the interest.
Well, what piqued my interest is, for some reason, and I don't know what it was, George Freeth, that it just rang a bell. And I kept thinking, where would I know this from? Where would I know this from? So I open the book, and I'm looking in the back, and I see that Waterman by David Davis was one of the books that was in your bibliography. I thought, that's it. So, and for those and the listeners will remember, that was about Duke Kahanamoku and his life. But there might not have been any Duke, and there might not have been any surfing in California or any of those things if it hadn't been for George Freeth. So how did you discover him?
So I had heard about Freeth here and there. I knew he was considered a legend, and I wanted to know more about him because he had come to California as a young man, this Hawaiian. He had taught people how to surf. He'd become a lifeguard. So I knew there was a lot of heroism there, and I thought this is a great story. But there was a lot of conflicting information and a lot of things that were not known about him. So I just started digging, basically, and wanted to find out what his motivations were for not only coming to California, but then staying in California for nearly a dozen years. It kind of became his adopted second home.
Well, the other thing I found fascinating was his dad was really sort of one of those relics of the empire, sort of at the end of the British Empire, one of those, you know, carrying the white man's burden and then not doing very well with it. How do you think George Freeth's family life influenced who he became?
That's a great question, because you're absolutely right. He had a grandfather and a great-grandfather that were generals in the British military. His father trained to be basically a young officer in Britain's merchant navy. He did that for a few years, but then he started to bounce around a lot, went to San Francisco, and finally landed in Honolulu. So his father really had itchy feet, as the Australians say. And George really, I think, picked up on that. I think he was influenced. He never stayed in one place for very long. He jumped around as a young man and even throughout his adult life. And I think that's probably the influence of his father.
Now, his mother was Hawaiian, his dad English. They both never had much money, but they were both connected in ways to the royalty of each place. So he clearly was raised by people who had learning and education and the like, but he really became one with the ocean in a way that nobody else in his family seemed to be.
He really did love the ocean and was there from a young age. You know, he was born at Waikiki. He learned all of the skills that he would later use in California as a lifeguard: swimming, diving, rowing, and surfing, of course. And it just seemed like he had grown up with the ocean. His father had taken him to a couple islands, Clipperton and Lysen Island, when he was running his guano mining operations. So Freeth was always surrounded by the ocean growing up as a young man. And he never lived very far from the ocean. I think he had opportunities to live away from the ocean and to do other things besides lifeguarding. He would have made more money, but he chose to live by the ocean for basically his entire life.
Also, Patrick, this is Rich. One of the things that was interesting, too, is that his own family background in some ways made it easier for him to relate to the different cultures that existed in Hawaii at the time.
He did. He was mixed race. Both his mother and grandmother were mixed race, Native Hawaiian. There were lots of English in the islands as well. So he had lots of connections, social connections, to the very highest levels of society, from the Hawaiian family down to the royal family, down to just basically ordinary Hawaiians. So his family had a lot of social clout you know, they would attend various ceremonies, you know, when the king would invite people for dignitaries. But he also had this kind of working class lifestyle in some ways. He just, you know, he worked at different jobs. So he just, you know, had this really interesting background that connected him to a lot of different people. And he was able to, you know, have conversations and interact with people at the highest social levels in California, you know, people like Henry Huntington and Abbot Kinney, and also just, you know, relate to ordinary people.
He did something else that I find fascinating. It wasn't he was a surfer, and he put on surfing exhibitions. He got people into surfing. He was a fancy diver, which said, you know, whether from platforms, and he was a world champion swimmer. I mean, he was an incredible swimmer, especially at distance. But what he probably did more than anything else was made all those activities far more safe, safer, made them safer than they ever would have been. And I find that amazing. If you could talk a little bit about that, it'd be great.
Sure, I think that's a great point. He was able to do, like you said, a lot of things very well, but his biggest impact was in coaching and mentoring others. He is basically the pioneer of professional lifeguard service in California. He may have been the first person to hold the position of a lifeguard in Hawaii. There were some U.S. congressmen who were visiting, taking a tour of the islands, and he was hired basically to be a lifeguard and to watch over them and their families. But in California, he really tried his best both to train and to organize lifeguards so that, and remember at this time, municipalities did not have any lifeguard service. Lifeguarding begins in California when the resorts and the bathhouses hire lifeguards to protect the patrons, both in the swimming pools and in the beach out in front of the bathhouses. And he really tries to get people to understand you need to have a lifeguard service. And lifeguards were hired for just the summer season, 4 months, and then they were let go. So he did his best to try to not only organize lifeguarding service, but also to innovate lifeguarding equipment so that his lifeguards would be trained, professional, and that they would make more efficient rescues.
We're talking with Patrick Mosier about his wonderful book, Surf and Rescue, George Freeth and the Birth of California Beach Culture. And I was stunned by how commonplace drownings were on the beaches of California before George Freeth began doing what he did.
Exactly. That's a good point. We tend to think of, you know, California beach culture is always having lifeguards and always being these big, beautiful beaches. But, you know, when Freeth arrived in Southern California in 1907, as I said, there were no municipal lifeguard services. And most of the people who moved to Southern California, you all will know that the West there was an influx of population in California at this time. So in 1910, there's about 500,000 people in Los Angeles County. By 1920, there's nearly 1 million. By 1930, there's over 2 million. But most of these people who arrived in Los Angeles, Southern California, came from the Midwest. So they were not familiar with the ocean or waves or currents or riptides. So with all of these people flooding in, the resort owners realized they had to start hiring lifeguards to protect these people, because if people were not safe, they wouldn't go out to the beach.
Well, and also one of his great rescues really was not swimmers, but were fishermen. And that was the most riveting story to me of all of them. He could have died doing what he did, and he saved a lot of people. If you could sort of give us the short version of that for our listeners, that'd be great.
Okay, sure. So it's December 1908 in Venice, California, along the Santa Monica Bay, and this storm suddenly hits. Water temperatures are in the mid-50s. All of a sudden, the siren goes off on the Venice Pier, and that's where the volunteer lifeguards stay. And they look out, and there's three boats coming in trying to outrace the storm. They'd already gotten caught in it. So they're trying to outrace the storm, get in behind the pier, you know, so they would be protected from the waves. Waves are too big to launch a lifeboat. There's these maybe 20-foot waves breaking over this rock breakwater that fronts the pier. So the pier is like this big T, and the rock breakwater is out in front of the top of the T. So Freeth, they can't launch the lifeboat. Freeth, with all of his training in the water, he offers to jump off the pier and swim out to these boats. So that's what he does. He jumps in the water, swims out in the storm surf, cold water, jumps into this boat. He swims a lifeline out there, but they're too far away. So he has to leave the lifeline behind. He gets in the boat, and the Japanese fishermen are so exhausted that they can't row. So he rows them into shore and basically uses, you know, their boat like a surfboard and kind of surfs it in on the wave. So he gets them onto shore safely, runs back up on the pier. In the meantime, there's another boat that's come in. He jumps off the pier a second time, swims out to the boat. Again, these guys, he's able to row in behind that, you know, the top of the pier and the T. So he gets them close enough so that the other volunteer lifeguards can throw out lines and they pull them in onto the pier and in safety. So Freeth by this time has probably been in the water an hour and a half. He's close to hypothermia. They take him to this lifeguard station. They give him a rub down. And while they're rubbing him down, the siren goes off again. There's another boat coming in. Still, they can't launch the boat. He jumps in a third time, gets off the table, swims out there. And what's happened is there's three fishermen in this boat. It gets capsized. They're all just clinging on to the underside of this boat. So he swims some kind of life preservers out there, makes sure that that everybody's up on the boat, kind of straps this, maybe it was made of cork, you know, around their waist, keeps them afloat. And finally, the other volunteer lifeguards are able to row the boat out, and they throw these three Japanese fishermen and Freeth into the boat, and then they row them into safety. So not only was it a great moment for Freeth, and he eventually won, you know, this was awarded this United States Life-Saving Service Gold Medal, and they're under the Department of Treasury. So not just great because he saved the lives of these seven fishermen, but it was the way that he did it that was so important, because he basically innovated swimming out to people in trouble and bringing them back into shore. So at that time, what they did was they got a crew together and they rowed out in a boat. But when the waves are too big, you know, the lifeboats can get capsized. And so he started training other lifeguards to swim out to save people. And that was this kind of seminal moment in life-saving history.
You write in the book that George Freeth created such a devoted following, especially among young people, because his idea of education always included physical education. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Exactly. So Freeth was so admired as a coach because when he taught young people, he wanted, you know, when you teach little kids, you have to get their bodies involved, right? You have to get them up and moving. They're not just going to sit there and listen to a lecture. So he would go to a high school. He would talk to them about resuscitation, about life saving, but he would get them into the pool, said, all right, we're going to play a game of water polo. And so water polo became important because the same holds that you use to break an opponent's lock on you in water polo, these are the same moves that a lifeguard could use when there's a victim out there and they clutch at a lifeguard to try to, you know, stay on top of the water. So he would use sports like water polo and surfing to make better lifeguards. And when he was training kids, he always got them in the water and he did it with them and alongside of them.
I remembered the one time as a lifeguard where I was pulling a kid in. It was a pool, thank God. Mm-hmm. And the father got me and the kid had me. And I thought, I always learned how to break one. No one told me what you do if you have to break two. And I remember I did it, and I thought later, I wish George Freeth had been around earlier because I wouldn't have gone through that panic. I would have known how to do this. As I was reading a book, I recalled that. You mentioned water polo. He was a fabulous water polo player. He's the only goalie I know that swam underwater and scored.
Exactly. He had this trick where, you know, 30 seconds before the end of a half, he would leave the goal, swim through the entire length of the pool, pop up and then score for his team, and then time would run out. I love that story you have of trying to save two people, because at the time it was an accepted practice that if somebody was grabbed a hold of you and you're a lifeguard and you couldn't break that hold, what they recommended was that you slugged him in the jaw, knocked him out, and then towed them into shore. So Freeth basically was teaching lifeguards, you don't have to hurt people in order to save them. You know, I can teach you methods to break these holds so that everybody arrives safely on shore.
Well, it's a remarkable story, and I'm so glad that you wrote this book, because I think so many people think of surf culture as being something from the 60s that starts with the Beach Boys, most of whom didn't even surf, or Jan and Dean or whatever. And to realize that it really goes back to the early part of the last century, this progression and all it took for this to happen, and all the changes and the plunges and the constructions of the waterfronts and the like. Freeth was there for so much of that. It had just such an incredible effect, and you know, on Duke Hanamoko and others, and Steinbeck, and people who wanted to learn to surf. I mean, he was really the guy. He was the go-to guy.
He was, and people remembered him, although he sort of got lost in history, you know, because of, you know, when he died, because of the global flu pandemic and World War I, and then you had the Roaring Twenties. All of that happened right after he died, so he kind of gets lost in history. And so one of the reasons why I got into this book is because I wanted to recuperate his story a little bit and really show, you know, his accomplishments and the impact that he had on California. And, you know, these days when people think of California, they think of surfing, they think of beach culture. And that really begins with George Freeth.
Well, it's a remarkable story, and I really thank you for joining us. And I hope if you find whoever it was that influenced George Freeth and research that and write that book, that you'll be back with us again. But it was really a pleasure to talk with you, Patrick. And I just want to say to everybody listening again, it's Surf and Rescue, George Freeth and the Birth of California Beach Culture. And it comes to you from the University of Illinois Press, who always gives us great books.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it. You all have a great day.
It was our pleasure, and we hope to talk to you again soon. Bye now.
Bye.
Patrick Mosier with us here on Downtown. And it's such a terrific read. And again, I knew virtually none of this other than Duke, because we had talked with David Davis.
And I just, you know, I just was so fascinated when I got into this. Whenever I had to put the book down, I was in sixes and sevens. I wanted to finish where I was because I feel like I've learned a whole period of history where, you know, we have the Spanish flu, we've got the First World War, we've got all these things that are in there, and you forget that when all those things are happening, other things are happening too.
And even the relationship between Hawaii and the United States.
Oh, yeah, and all the, you know, the annexation, the destruction of Hawaiian royalty, first of all, the British were anything less than benevolent to the Hawaiians, and then, you know, the U.S. comes running in and basically sees it as an income source, right?
Exactly. What's coming up next? You're off next week.
I'm off next week, and we're working out the details of when we will talk to Miles Schrag about Filbert Bayi.
Excellent.
And we'll talk a little more about Filbert Bayi. Before that, we're going to talk to Miles probably in September, and I think the week after I'm not here is the week is your other vacation week, right?
Nope. You'll have 1 week before we go on vacation.
Good. Well, I'll be back.